They say that in the case of mysterious deaths, the first 48 hours are critical. If investigators can't make a breakthrough in that time, their chances of resolving the case are very much diminished. But what if you don't make a breakthrough in 48 hours or 48 days? What if you don't make a breakthrough in 48 years? Welcome to the mysterious case of Fred the Head, one of the UK's most baffling unsolved crimes. Episode 49, Scouting for Boys. In the last episode, we took a deep dive into the discovery story again, and that's something we'll continue with in the first part of this episode. In particular, is there any way of verifying any of this information? Now, at the same time, I've been able to dig a little more into the circumstances surrounding John Jick's disappearance and some of the people that John was associated with around the time of his disappearance. That's an interesting story. But first things first, we know the basic discovery story. We know it so well, I won't repeat it. But the timings seem a little bit off. David Nathan claims he took the initial steps in the discovery story around 7:30. Well, that looks a bit shaky, simply because we know it was pretty dark, and police records indicate that the call about the body also came in at 7:30. And we know both of those things couldn't have happened at the same time, because a lot went on after David Nathan took those initial steps to go and shoot pigeons. In the discovery story, Garth Hampcopsall was at the boys' grammar school, teaching the boys to shoot, according to David Nathan. And I wanted to know more about that. I never take anything at face value, so I needed to satisfy myself that that actually happened. In his various statements, David Nathan has mentioned the Scouts and the Army Cadets. Now, they're two different organisations, but the common thread is the grammar school about half a mile away from Garth Hampcopsall's house. So I needed to talk to some people who would have been either in the Army Cadets or Scouts at the grammar school at that time. I was lucky. The grammar school has an old boys Facebook page which I joined, and suddenly, and with the great help of a man called Keith Large, I was speaking to as many Army Cadets or Scouts from around that time as I could possibly want to. So, starting with the Army Cadets, I spoke to two or three members of that cadet troop from that time, the end of the 1960s to the start of the 1970s. They were adamant that Garth Hampcopsall would not have been involved with them. You see, they had arms and ammunition already stored at the cadet hut at the school. They also had access to army personnel if they needed any training, and their commander, Captain Jack Plale, was a highly experienced ex-officer. There was really no need at all for any civilians like Garth Hampcopsall to be involved. A number of those cadets I spoke to remembered that the cadets always met after school on a Friday afternoon, just before 4 p.m. In fact, they were given special dispensation to wear their army cadet uniform on Friday afternoons for that reason at the grammar school. And as the school took children from a wide radius, there was no point in sending all these children home only to return for army cadets. So army cadets started straight after school on Friday afternoon and ran for a couple of hours. None of the cadet force that I spoke to remembered ever being instructed by Garth Hampcopsall. And whilst one definitely recognised him, he was certain it wasn't in the capacity of any involvement in the cadets. So, I'm as certain as I can be that Garth Hampcopsall was not instructing the Army Cadets on that Friday afternoon. But what about the Scouts? Well, here it is more possible. I spoke to a couple of the Scouts from that period of time. Scouts started around 6 p.m. and it was held next to the Army cadet hut, a different room in the same building. They shared the rifle range. One of the scouts does remember being instructed in shooting by someone. He remembers a .22 rifle with a Martini action. He remembers that amount of detail about that instruction. And he was sure, for the scouts, instruction in firearms was a real rarity. That's why he remembers it. And he remembers that it happened no more than twice in his 6 years in the scouts. So it stood out to him. I showed him a photograph of Garthan Gopsall. He didn't recognise him. But it is 55 years ago. So what does this all mean for us? Well, I didn't get confirmation that Garthan Gopsall was at the grammar school on that Friday afternoon, but we definitely cannot rule it out either. And if it was, it was with the scouts, because it definitely wasn't with the army cadets. And because the scouts, they met between 6 and 9, well, that is probably in the time frame when the story of Fred started. So I think we should assume that that part of the story is probably correct, but not the 7:30 time frame for David Nathan leaving for the first time. I think he probably left soon after Garthan Gopsall had left for the school, around 6 p.m, while there's still plenty of daylight. So if I was a betting man, and if what David Nathan is telling us is true, I suspect it was around 6 p.m. when David Nathan went out shooting. I can't definitively prove it, but it's still daylight. His colleague has just left work. I think it's most likely. But of course, that's not really the issue. The issue really is what David Nathan did on finding the school. He didn't ring the police. He didn't wait for a couple of hours for his colleague to come back. What he did was quite panicky. He rang the school. He interrupted Garthan Gopsall's instruction. And what did Garthan Gopsall do? Well, he didn't finish what he was doing or wait an hour or two and just get back naturally. No, he dropped everything. He left the scouts. He even left the guns and ammunition, and returned instantly before anyone rang the police. Now, it might just be me, but something just doesn't feel right about that. I mentioned in the last episode that I was in contact with a man, perhaps the man, who police were particularly interested in tracing after the disappearance of John Jick. And earlier this week, I had the second of two long conversations with him, where we discussed his memories of the time, his memories of John Jick, and the circumstances surrounding John's disappearance. Now, the investigation to John Jick keeps providing little bits of evidence that seem to point to a connection to Fred, and we're going to hear about another one today. But I'm not going to reveal the name of the man I was talking to. He wants to preserve his privacy, and who can blame him? But he was good enough to share his memories with me. He first met John when he became a Cub Scout around the age of 8, in the late 50s. John Jick was the Cub leader of the 1st Douglas Scout Group, a kind, welcoming man. Our man was quite shy. He was a shy, insular boy, but John, as a leader of the Cubs, got him involved. As he grew older, the man we're talking to became a scout around 11 or 12 years of age. His friendship with John developed. John Jick used to give him a lift home after scouts in his mini car. John Jick was fond of minis, but John Jick didn't give anyone a lift home. Physically, he remembers John really well. Very slim, short, mousy brown, straight hair, always appearing older than he actually was. In fact, our man was very surprised when he learned that John was only 38 when he disappeared. He thought he was quite a lot older than that. In 1965 or 1966, John Jick took him to London alone to see a gang show. They shared a bedroom, a 15-year-old boy and a 34-year-old man. John Jake had asked the permission of his parents to take him. They were happy, they were pleased, the boy was excited. He'd never been to the mainland, never mind London, in the middle of the swinging 60s. And nothing inappropriate happened. And that unusual friendship continued. John Jick, who is now Cub Commissioner for the whole island, but a man in his 30s living with his parents, and the shy, naive teenager. But then something did happen. The boy finished his O-levels, now could leave school. John Jick said he knew of a job that would suit him with his friend, a man called Ken Dale. Not Ken Davis, that's me. Ken Dale. It was at the Road Transport and General Assurance Company in Athol Street, Douglas. Athol Street is the main business thoroughfare of Douglas. It was a good job. An insurance clerk, perfect for this 16-year-old straight out of school. Part of a much bigger company called General Accident. Very secure position. And at a time when most of the youth needed to move to the mainland, our 16-year-old had just landed himself a very good job. However, Ken Dale made him feel very uncomfortable. He was a shy, naive teenager, and Ken Dale was a very unusual person. He was a very effeminate man, and he didn't hide it, which on the Isle of Man was either brave or stupid. Ken Dale is described as resembling closely John Inman, the outwardly gay character in the UK sitcom Are You Being Served? That's probably as close a portrayal as you're going to get. Now, I should say at this point, it wouldn't and shouldn't matter now, but in the late 1960s in the Isle of Man, it mattered a lot. I've met a lot of gay men. None of them are like that. It's almost like a cartoon, really, but that is exactly how Ken Dale has been described to me. And one evening, John Jick asked our teenager if he would like to go for a meal with him and Ken Dale. And they drove to a quite distant restaurant in the north of the island, a long, long way from Douglas. And again, nothing untoward happened. But Ken Dale's behaviour became more and more camp as the night wore on. And our teenager became more and more uncomfortable with that. But nothing happened. No sexual advances, nothing inappropriate. The next day, our teenager mentions to the other people in the office what went on the night before. And Ken Dale is summarily dismissed for inappropriate behaviour. Now, according to our teenager, there was no inappropriate behaviour, except perhaps a certain flamboyance and an overt campness. Now, we don't know what the history is. But there's no doubt, purely on the evidence of what had happened the night before, Ken Dale is dismissed from his job. And our man never saw Ken Dale again. And interestingly, he never saw John Jick again. John Jick, who by that time had had over 10 years friendship with this boy, from the age of 8 to the age of 18, completely disappears from his life. And all this is happening in 1968, about 6 months before John Jick's disappearance. Our teenager also leaves the insurance company. It's secure, but it's boring. It's got nothing to do with what happened to Ken Dale. He applies and is offered a job at Pilkington's Glass, a big glass manufacturer in St. Helens, about 12 miles from Liverpool. At the weekends, he lives with his sister in Crosby, another suburb of Liverpool, and during the week, he lives at the YMCA in St. Helens. But then one day, in February 1969, the police arrive. Thanks for listening, and in particular, a warm welcome to all our new listeners who have found their way here via the Truth and Justice podcast. I was fortunate enough to be asked on there by Bob Ruff to talk about the work that we've been doing. And Bob is a great host and he asks some very good questions. And that hour-long interview is perhaps the best synopsis of where we've got to as there is, so it's worth a listen. I'll put a link in the show notes. I certainly have noticed a spike in listeners after that interview, so I'm grateful to Bob, but I'm also grateful to those who are investing their time becoming listeners and becoming part of the Fred family. Many of them have also found their way to the Facebook group, The Mysterious Case of Fred the Head, the podcast, and there you'll find a very receptive crowd of people ready to debate and discuss in a very positive, friendly and courteous way. It's a joy the way that has grown and the way everybody is interacting so well. And if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a rating wherever you get your podcasts, as it really helps other people find it. And as you know, we don't monetize any of this. There's no extras for people who can pay a bit more. Everybody gets everything for free. All I ask is if you enjoy it, pass it on. The more people who know about Fred, the more chance we have of solving it. Right, back to the story. So the police have arrived on his doorstep, and the police think he's involved. There seems to be a letter from John Jick. It's perhaps the suggestion of a meeting, the meeting that John Jick was making his excuses to attend. The police first went to his sister's house and then to Pilkington Glass, after warning his sister not to contact him in the meantime. And they arrive at his workplace, and then they spend the next 7 hours asking him the kind of questions that I ask him. What was John Jick like? Did anything happen? And what happened to John? And after those 7 hours of interrogation, he never hears from the police again. Looking back, he's still a bit confused about what happened. Who wouldn't be after 55 years? There is a vague recollection of a letter, but he doesn't think he ever received one. But he's sure there was no meeting in Liverpool, either planned or that actually took place. A few months later, in the summer of 1969, he's back in the Isle of Man. No one ever talked about John Jick, which is in many ways odd. He was a very well-known person, and he'd only gone missing a few months before, simply vanished. But on the Isle of Man in the late 1960s, things that people were uncomfortable with were brushed under the carpet. John Jick was in the process of being forgotten. It's fair to say now that, on reflection, the man who knew John Jick considers he was the victim of grooming, being slowly introduced into a lifestyle by John Jick and Ken Dale that he didn't really want. He was, on the face of it, in a very vulnerable position. His promising career is dependent on Ken Dale and has been obtained as a direct result of John Jick's intervention. He could be seen as owing both of those older men. He's in a very awkward position. So, were those older men trying to take advantage of that situation to get access to a naive and vulnerable young man? Well, today, with the benefit of hindsight and perhaps a little bit more wisdom, he thinks they were. Which for me is disappointing. I'm on John Jick's side, really, but you need to know the truth. I think John Jick probably did have an attachment to this shy, introverted young man. Probably saw something of himself in him. But, as we must always remind ourselves, John Jick never, ever did anything that could be construed as inappropriate to him, to this boy, or to anyone else. But there are two very interesting things that came out of that conversation. Firstly, Ken Dale, clearly very close friend of John Jick, perhaps his best friend, perhaps, maybe, more than that. Ken Dale seems to disappear after his dismissal. Who can blame him? And by the way, there's a lot of homophobia going on here, and I mean by his employer. I mean, nothing really happened, but he was dismissed, he lost his job. So where did he go? And the reason that interests me is because I just wouldn't believe that John Jick would have lost contact with him. I also don't believe that John Jick died on the 1st of February 1969. Remember, a colleague saw him in the Wirral 3 months later. So, does Ken Dale leave the Isle of Man? And does John Jick, when presented with possible exposure in February 1969, reach out to Ken Dale? I've got a feeling Ken Dale is key to the story of what happened to John Jick. And if I can find out what happened to Ken Dale, I might just get a lot closer to finding out what really happened to John Jick. The second important point is something mentioned about John Jick's appearance, his physical appearance. Our young scout knew John Jick well for over a decade. He knew him very well. He shared a hotel room with him. He probably knows him better than anyone else still living. And there's a specific characteristic he remembers very clearly. John's right shoulder was distinctly lower than his left shoulder. Now, I'm interested in this because of the torticollis diagnosis in Fred by Caroline Wilkinson back in 2016. But a lower shoulder and torticollis, a congenital problem of the neck, well, they're two completely different conditions. Or are they? We're very lucky to have some very smart people as part of the Facebook group and who follow the podcast. Steve Playful, for example, or Professor Stephen Playful, Clinical Director of Paediatric Care, to give him his full title. And I've been speaking with Steve about this very issue. And he sent me a note a couple of days ago. And that note says this. Hey Ken, I have attached a couple of photos of adults with neglected torticollis. These are freely available on the internet and not patients I have any contact with. You'll be able to Google that term and find them yourself. As you know, the torticollis pulls the head down to one side, and life is quite challenging with your head tilted to one side. So patients compensate for this by dropping the shoulder on the unaffected side to straighten the head up a bit. Try keeping your ear on your shoulder for 10 minutes and then do some activities of daily life. You'll find yourself leaning over to the opposite side to straighten up your head so you can read more easily, for example. It is absolutely possible for a close friend of someone with neglected torticollis, even having seen them with their shirt off, to describe their physical problem as actually being a dropped shoulder. There are, of course, other reasons for having a dropped shoulder, but that is definitely one of them. Every best wish, Steve. Well, well, well. Fascinating. And again, another connector between John Jick and Fred, and potentially a very important one. I still believe, by the way, it's very much more likely not to be John Jick than to be John Jick. But this is definitely a new factor that supports the John Jick theory. Finally, before I go, something about the current police investigation. I'm just picking up a few indicators that the police investigation is not quite as dormant as I thought. There's been a change in case officers, and I just get a feeling, getting a sense, that there's some stuff going on there again. Maybe they're working on something, which is great, because I don't care who solves it as long as it gets solved. Fred's been unnamed and unclaimed for far, far too long. But if there are any changes on that, you'll be the first to know. But that's for next time. So until next time, have a good one. The Mysterious Case of Fred the Head is a GSC Media production. Written, produced, and narrated by myself, Ken Davis.